Good evening. I'm Dorothy Graves, and this is Science Cafe. We are here on 89.1 KUAR, the fourth Tuesday of every month from 6:05 to 6:30 to talk about a science topic and give you the chance to call in with your questions. Our number here in the studio, 569-8494. That's area code 501-569-8494. And our topic this evening is exploring social media in medicine. Joining me in the studio, I have Jared Gardner. He's an associate professor of pathology at UAMS. Jared, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So I don't usually introduce my guests, but I want to give a little bit of background information about you to draw that line between pathology professor and social media. Why are you sitting here in the studio with me? So you're a dermatopathologist.
Yes.
And a bone and soft tissue sarcoma pathologist. So you're a bona fide doctor. You're a bona fide pathologist. You're big in education. You lead some educational programs at UAMS. And you develop some social media sites that in those areas of interest of yours that just sort of exploded globally. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
I guess 3 or 4 years ago, I had thought about maybe starting a blog or a website to do some teaching. And I I don't know much about coding, and I thought, I don't know how to set up a website. But then I thought, maybe I'll start a Facebook group to talk about skin tumors and stuff. And so I set up a DermPath group, and then also a bone and soft tissue tumor, which are really rare tumors that people get sometimes. And I set up a group, and I thought I'd invite, 100 of my friends and just share some cool cases. And all these people from all over the world started joining, and within like a couple months, we had like 5,000 members. I think there were at like 18,000 and 28,000 members now. I mean, and with just in a few years. So it made me realize that there's evidently an interest and a need in this. And then I started using Twitter, and I've been doing some live tweeting from national meetings with a group of colleagues who are also like-minded. And people from all over the world said, it's just like we're there at the medical meeting with you. People from, the developing world who said, we'll never have enough money to come to the United States and go to a meeting, but it's like we're there learning right next to you guys because you're taking the time to tweet about the new cutting-edge technology in medicine that's coming out. So those kind of things are really inspiring, and it just kind of has grown and grown from there.
So when you created those Facebook groups initially, who was jumping into those conversations? What were they sharing? Were these professionals? Were these patients? Who was engaged?
Mostly they were other pathologists from all over the world. And that's the thing about Facebook and Twitter and all of the social media sites. They really have the infrastructure to recognize what kind of stuff you'll be interested in because of who you're friends with and what groups they're in. And so I didn't really have to promote it very much. I did a little bit the first month or so. And then all of a sudden, just all these people started finding it and joining. And, sometimes they're medical students or other interested people and occasionally patients. But mostly other doctors, and they would share cases, and sometimes they would share, hey, here's a nice example of this rare thing. Sometimes it was people on the other side of the world saying, we don't have anyone with expertise in this. Can you help us with a diagnosis? Which was a little bit kind of nerve-wracking at first, like, am I allowed to do this? Is there a way to kind of give guidance without giving an official consultation? Am I going to get sued? I had all those questions at first, and over time I've realized that there is a way, I think, to help people brainstorm ideas for diagnosis without, making a firm, a firm commitment to it. And, it's different than giving an official consultation. So I think it can be helpful to people.
If you're just joining us, this is Science Cafe, and I am talking with Dr. Jared Gardner. He's a pathologist at UAMS, but we're talking about the use of social media in medicine. You can tell it's been a long day. I'm tripping over my words. So there's one question that came up to me when I first learned a while back that you were so engaged with social media. From the patient perspective, we're so in touch with HIPAA, and everything's about privacy and everything's about confidentiality. Social media seems to be very counterintuitive to that. So what provisions do you have in place, or how do you think about that to where that's not any sort of risk?
That's a great question, and it's probably the most common question I get about social media is I've had someone interrupt me in the middle of a lecture once and say, but what about HIPAA? They were so worried that I was like, I promise you, I think about this more than most people because I'm constantly thinking about everything I put on Twitter or Facebook can be seen by the whole world. So I always think about that to make sure if anyone could see this, would they recognize who this patient is? Would I even be able to recognize it? So those are the things I think about. So anytime I share like a picture of a microscopic slide, for example, I don't say when it was from. I always make up the history. If it was a 25-year-old woman, I might say it was a 30-year-old man or something like that. I always change things a little bit. If I have something really rare, I don't ever go and say, hey, look at this rare tumor I diagnosed today. There's only 5 of them in the world. Because you know what? That patient would know that was them. And so I think, and with with microscopic slides, it's easy because even if it's my own skin and I look at skin all day long, I wouldn't recognize my own skin under a microscope any different from yours or anyone else's. So there's no way anyone could look at that and figure it out. But one of my colleagues, Eve Crane, and she was a fellow at Johns Hopkins in hematopathology, we wrote a paper together about how to share images and protect patient privacy. And it's actually one of the most cited papers I've written now. We just wrote it a year and a half ago because everyone has this question. So we wrote the paper so that people could see in the literature, here's how you can do it and how you can keep HIPAA respected and how you can respect privacy and still educate the public and other doctors with social media.
Our number here in the studio, 569-8494, area code 501, 569-8494. If you have a question for Dr. Jared Gardner talking about social media and medicine. So of the different social media platforms, considering we usually have a pretty broad audience, we're going to have some people who are real familiar with it, some people who don't use a lot of social media. Can you go through the different platforms, kind of describe their usefulness in the context of what you do?
Sure. So for Facebook, I think most people are familiar because the vast majority of people now use Facebook. Facebook is useful because so many people use it. It has an enormous audience, and it has the ability to create discussion groups that can either be closed or even secret if you want. You can really set privacy levels, and you can have really in-depth conversations with other people about whatever topic of interest there is. And in fact, I'm a member of multiple rare cancer patient support groups. I joined to volunteer a few years ago, and that's totally changed my life. It's been amazing to interact with these patients who have these rare cancers that I diagnose and to learn what their perspective is. It's made me a better doctor for sure. But that could never happen, say, on Twitter, which is very public, and the whole point is sharing stuff for everyone to see. So I think Facebook has the benefit of having those groups and of having a really broad reach. And then Twitter, the benefits of Twitter are that you can share stuff and anyone can see it. And at first I thought, who will even want to follow me? And lo and behold, a bunch of people were interested in what I had to say and the cases I shared and things like that. And the other thing is that Twitter will put you in touch with other people that you would never have normally met otherwise. You'll see that you both are interested in following one other person, and you're like, oh, this other person looks interesting. Maybe I'll follow them. You might not do that on Facebook because you don't feel – usually people on Facebook – friend other people that they know in real life. And on Twitter, it's not like that at all. You can follow, the president or movie stars or athletes or anybody, and it's not that private. And then Snapchat, I still don't really understand. I just started using it a year ago because all of my medical students do, and I realized that I'm actually pretty old. That was a really, really a breaking moment for me, as I was like, I don't know how to use this. There's no buttons. You have to swipe and figure out where to touch. And all my med students are like, oh, poor Dr. Gardner. He's trying real hard, but I'm still learning. So.
But it was bonding for you and
bonding,
your students.
Right. And Instagram, I think, is kind of just a way to publicly share pictures, which is great for pathology because everything we do is about images, I think.
I was going to say, that's
it's perfect.
It's perfect for you.
Yep.
Our number here in the studio, 569-8494, area code 501, 569-8494. So we did a Facebook video earlier. KUAR posted it on their Facebook page, and we asked for people to post comments and questions before we got together tonight here in the studio. I wanted to read some of one of the comments that we got. This is from Lisa Sutherland. She said that she's real excited about our topic because she's a social worker in North Little Rock, and several years ago she founded a secret closed Facebook group called Therapists Who Rock. They've grown by word of mouth to over 2,600 mental health professionals around the state of Arkansas, and it's a great resource for ongoing mental health news, research development, continuing education, and job opportunities. Are you seeing that kind of use of Facebook grow and grow more with time?
Yeah, that's actually really wonderful. My wife is a child psychiatrist and in private practice, and so I recognize there's a huge need for mental health help, and especially for people who work in mental health because it's such an emotionally draining and stressful job to deal with all these issues that are hard to handle. And so to have that kind of group, I think, is wonderful because they can share resources. And also there's emotional support we may be doctors, we may be healthcare workers, but we need help too, like anyone else, in dealing with difficult situations. So I think those groups are a great sense of rapport. And there's actually a physician's mom group, which I think has like 75,000 women doctors who have children in it. It's enormous. It's huge. There's also a physician's dad group that recently got created. And it's really cool to just be able to be on there with doctors of all different specialties, talking about random stuff, but just to kind of have that sense of bonding and being able to say, yeah, medicine's tough, but this is why we do it. And I think that's cool. So I can see that, yeah, there's definitely a growing need for those groups.
And I know from my personal experience, so I have a child who has Down syndrome, and we have tremendous Facebook groups available to us. Some are locally based, which is great because it tells us about local resources and stuff, and it's been a lifesaver for me and a lot of other parents. So I think we have a caller on the line, Laura from Little Rock. Can you hear me?
Hi, yes, I can. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What's your question? Dr. Garner, it's Laura Battle. I was just listening to you on the radio, and I know we've talked a lot about Twitter, and I think a lot of times it baffles a lot of us physicians, even some of the younger physicians. So I wanted to see if you could talk about any possible resources there might be for guides to understanding how to use Twitter.
Thank you, Laura. That's a great question. I found that I was always talking about or preaching about whatever, about why doctors should use social media, and people would say, okay, fine, you've convinced me, but how? So I actually made, I have a wiki website about pathology, but I made a page on there that I made into a pathologist or a social media resource guide for how to get started. And it basically starts, here's how you build a Twitter account, and here's how you got to upload a profile picture and follow a few people, and here's some guides. So it's got links and everything, and I don't know if there's a comment section on the website, but I can add a link there. If you just Google social media guide pathologist, it will be the first thing on Google because no one else would have something like that up on Google. So anyway, I think it's useful not just for pathologists, but any doctors or professionals. I think the same rules are kind of applicable across the board. So
that's awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we'll get that posted because we'll post this program probably within 24, 48 hours. Okay. And we'll get that up there as well. Again, our number 569-8494, area code 501-569-8494. So you've spoken a little bit about in the classroom and working with your students. You mentioned the Facebook group. How do you use the other forms of social media in an educational setting specifically?
So we started, I had been doing Facebook groups mainly for people online, but then one of the other co-directors of I teach the musculoskeletal and skin block in the second year of med school. I co-direct that with one of the PhDs. And Dr. Wessinger, who was my co-director at the time, said, well, let's do Facebook for the class. And I thought, oh, I actually hadn't thought of that. So, and he actually just retired recently. So see, age is no barrier to being social media savvy. And we found that was a great way to interact with the students more and kind of build rapport with them. But also, I'll share like YouTube videos. I have a YouTube channel, and I'll sit down at the microscope with some slides and turn on the video camera and record a video of like, here's how you diagnose basal cell carcinoma or nevus or whatever. And I put those up so that people all over the world can see them. But I also will use those links when I give a lecture. I'll reference and give a list of links to the students to say, oh, if you want some more information or if you want a better view of how this tumor looks, here's a link. Just go watch this video. So it's nice because it's a resource that's there that they can watch again and again. And it's actually nice for me because it makes me more efficient. I can just give people links when they have questions. So things that I get asked a lot, I make a video about it and then I share the link. So like I made one this morning actually with my fellow at 7 a.m. We came in, he pulled slides, we talked about vasculitis, and it'll be up on my YouTube channel in a couple of days. So I think that's an enormously useful way to teach now. And I try to incorporate that not only online, but for my own students at UAMS also.
Well, it seems like that would work really well, like in higher education, where the teachers are the experts in the field and you're making your own educational materials.
Absolutely. And I really wish I could convince more of my colleagues to do that because it's again, this wealth of information, and they go and give the same lecture again and again. Why not take that teacher, same 150 students, but then make it available to the whole world online, to people in developing nations that don't have access to resources? Here, we're surrounded with links to journals and books and things that are funded by universities. But if you live in Afghanistan, guess what? You don't have very many books or things that you have resources for. You don't have the money to buy the newest edition of something. And so to be able to bring relevant content that I use for my own diagnosis of patients in practice to share that online, I think that's a way that I can kind of give back to the world and help other patients, even people that I'll never meet on the other side of the world. So I kind of feel obligated to do this to help.
569-8494, area code 501-569-8494. If you've just joined us, this is Science Cafe, and I'm Dorothy Graves. I'm talking with Dr. Jared Gardner. He's a pathologist at UAMS who is very prolific in his use of social media, every place that he can find. So to kind of follow up on that, with regard to your colleagues, your fellow physicians, are they more agreeable to using social media in a professional setting than an educational setting? Or how do you find their openness? Because it's new for a lot of them. I mean, obviously, the new physicians fresh out of med school, they're going to be much more adept at it. But, you know, we've got a workforce that spans many generations.
I think that it has taken some time for other doctors to get on board with this, but as more and more of us do this and are successful with it, and you know, now I have, you know, I lead social media for some from large organizations. I've leveraged social media towards actually getting promoted in my job. I included social media information in my promotion and tenure packet when I went up for promotion to associate professor. So I've tried to show people that, yeah, this is fun and we can educate, but there's actually something in it for you career-wise too. So I'm trying to convince people that way that there really are, you know, it's because people say, well, I don't have enough time to do this extra thing. And so I'm trying to help people see there's a lot of really great benefits and it can amplify the kind of work we already do in medicine, particularly in academic medicine. But yeah, I think that now, like at least in pathology, there are several thousand pathologists on. I actually keep a list that I manually add to. Every time I find a new pathologist on Twitter, I add them to the list. And there's, I think I'm around 4,000 now. So there are now the kind of the scale is tipped and enough people are doing it that new residents realize, oh, I should do this. All the senior residents are doing it. Age is not necessarily a barrier. I know people that are retired that use social media. Dr. Philip McKee is a retired dermatopathologist living in France. And he recently joined social media and created a Facebook group about dermpath, and he wrote like one of the major dermatopathology textbooks. So to see some of his stature posting cool cases on Facebook every day and helping and answering questions, I mean, it's just, to me, mind-blowing and awesome. So yeah, age, when people say, oh, well, I'm too old, and I'm like, yeah, I know retired pathologists that are doing this, so you're not too old. I do think that people are a little hesitant to join Twitter if they only have used Facebook just because Twitter seems new and hard to understand. And, you know, there are plenty of controversies that have spawned from Twitter. And I think that that also scares people a little. But I think for doctors, actually, Twitter is for professional social media use. I always tell people just join Twitter first. And that I think it's so great because it's open and it's public and it's not like private. You don't have to worry about people seeing pictures of your kids if you don't want that or whatever. So I'm pretty open. I actually am friends with lots of people I've never met all over the world. They see pictures of the food I make at home and my kids and, you know, what we open at Christmas morning or whatever. And it's enriched my life. It's been a great thing overall rather than a bad thing. So, yeah, we're getting there. But, yeah, people are still reticent sometimes.
Do you get any pushback from students who are like, I don't want my teacher in my social media space? What do you do about that?
Well, that's actually a good question. What I tell the students at the beginning of the block is I say, you're welcome to friend my personal Facebook account. I'm friends with lots of people. It's not really that private or personal to me, but you don't have to. So you're welcome to do it. So I don't send a friend request to a student because I wouldn't want them to be like, oh crap, now I've got to answer this friend request or I'll, you know, it'll be held against me or something. Yeah. Not like I get to pick what people's grades are. It's all just numbers that come up on the system anyway. But I tell them, and about, I'd say a third to a half of the med school class each year probably friends me when they go through. And I always tell them, you're welcome to. It helps me get to know them better. You know, I'll see some funny joke they post and then I remember, oh, that's that guy that's really funny. And by the time they graduate, you know, I might have only known them briefly otherwise, but now I know them pretty well. And I kept in touch with them when they go off to residency. And, you know, if I know them, I can help them more if they need help down the road. So overall, it's been good, but I try to be really respectful of that boundary. I don't feel there's any problem with them friending me. I mean, they're going to be doctors in a few years. If I can't trust them to be friends with me on Facebook, am I going to trust them to go out and take care of patients? And that's the real answer I give when people, other doctors say, well, what about boundaries? It's like, these people are going to be our colleagues in a few years. We shouldn't be letting them into our med school if we don't trust them. And I've never had a problem yet. The med students are awesome, and I love being friends with them on Facebook.
Our number, 569-8494, area code 501-569-8494. Talking with Dr. Jared Gardner of UAMS about the use of social media in medicine. What are the vulnerabilities of social media? Like, what can you not do? What are the weak points that you've discovered along the way?
Great question. So we talked about privacy and HIPAA. You always have to be extra careful just because it's just like it's like talking about a patient in an elevator, only the elevator has like, you know, 6 billion people in it. So you got to be really, really careful. Also, I think it's easy because there's no filter. It's easy to say what you want and to say something when you're angry or upset or maybe your inhibitions are lowered. You know, you've had a couple of glasses of wine or something, and you can say something that you can't take back. And in the moment, it might seem fine. And then later you realize, well, that didn't come across the same way that I thought it would. And I've worked real hard to avoid those things, but I've made some mistakes and, you know, nothing that's gotten me fired or anything, but things that later I thought that would have been better to say differently in retrospect. So I try to be extra careful. And if I ever feel right before I push the tweet button or whatever, Is this? No, the answer is save to drafts and think about it tomorrow. And usually that tweet never gets sent. So it's kind of like in the old days when, you know, the presidents or whoever would write out all these letters of fiery anger to their political opponents, and then they'd store them in their desk drawer, and then we find them 100 years later, right? And that's why we know all the things Abraham Lincoln wrote and stuff, because of all the things that they saved in their drawer and never walked down to the post to send. But we don't have to walk down to the post now. We just hit tweet, and that's a danger. And then, I mean, it is a time. It does take time, right? And I think there are lots of ways to do it efficiently. But, I mean, sometimes I'll open up Twitter just to make one tweet. And, you know, 15 minutes later, I realize I'm scrolling through stuff that is not really helpful to me. And so there are certain times, like early in the morning, I wake up early so I can write papers. That's the time I'm most productive. I really try to avoid using social media then, because it's so easy to get sucked in and feel so productive for spending an hour on Twitter when I could have been writing a research paper or something. So you kind of have to know yourself and what your limits are. But there's a few negatives, but a lot of positives if you use it the right way.
Yeah, now one of the things that we're hearing more and more about is an issue of addiction to social media. And so if you've got these kids who are addicted to social media, and then you're encouraging to use them for education, or your peers, you know, because professionals are just as susceptible as students, so I don't want to single them out. So how do you, when you have these conversations about social media, how do you present that balance?
I mean, I guess that's a good point. There probably are some people that truly have addictions. Those people, though, are already probably social media users. I feel like the chance that I'm going to recruit one of my colleagues and they're going to become hopelessly addicted to social media is probably relatively low. So I think the risk-benefit ratio is pretty favorable there. For the young doctors that are coming up, I mean, they're almost all of them are social media users already. And so I feel like that's the thing is people, and I even tell them, you guys are going to be on Facebook anyway. I'd rather that when you're trying to waste time on Facebook, you see some post of mine pop up and you think, oh yeah, I need to study for that test. Or, oh, that's really interesting. And that's what happens with me. Even if I go on Facebook just to look at friends' posts, pathology posts pop up all the time and I'll say, ooh, that's really neat. I haven't seen that article yet. And I'll get distracted. The same things that make social media addicted, why not turn that to use and make that educational aspect addictive too? I mean, we have to learn. So why not make it more fun and an easier way to learn? So I think that's kind of my stance on that.
Do you think, obviously you found great ways to use social media for medical education. What about other types of education? Are they as conducive? So thinking about the humanities or the arts and other sciences or business even.
Sure. There are actually like a lot of librarians on social media. I didn't really know what librarians did, but because I follow some of them on Twitter, I found they have all these really cool things that they do that you wouldn't really have thought of otherwise. There are lots of different humanities, I think, that use social media, especially Twitter. So yeah, I think it's you know, it's a medium, right? It's social media. It's a medium just like radio or the regular internet or email or books or whatever. We can use it to share content. The content that we put in it is what matters, right? It's just a medium and it's a powerful one. And we're the ones who decide what content to put there. And I think any kind of content you want to share, you can put it out there and other people that are interested will be able to find it eventually. And I think that's why it's so powerful.
Do you think social media is a good tool for engaging physicians in rural areas who do not have as much, you know, they don't have the access to a big academic center or a big hospital? And, you know, we all know there are challenges that rural healthcare settings face that we don't in a city like Little Rock.
Absolutely. I think that's a really great tool because, like you said, we can get a group of doctors together and have a meeting here or have a grand rounds. But if you live a couple hours from Little Rock, it's not convenient for you to drive here. But so we actually do in pathology, we've started doing journal club. Journal club is something that we do in medicine. We, you know, everyone brings a journal article and we all sit down in a room and we discuss it. The problem is who has time to do that, right? I mean, we do it, but it's really hard and we have to make great effort to find a way to fit that into our day or we have to meet at night or something. But we actually do a Twitter journal club. So like tomorrow night, we have one about DermPath. It's called DermPath JC and it's on Twitter and we discuss an article from all over the world. We can discuss an article together on Twitter, even though we live in all different places. It's wonderful. So I think that social media is a great tool to have those things. And it, just like that, it could be applied to rural medicine the same.
So we have a comment on Facebook. I'm not sure if I'm reading this correctly. It's from Karen Gardner Marks. How do I get to Jared's speaking event?
I would say no relation, but that's actually my mom. So I did not set
Yay,
this
mom.
Up, I promise. But thanks, mom. Hi. Yes, you can come to one of my events one day, mom. I'll set that up for you.
So is there anything that you can share with the broader public in terms of your speaking events, or what's she after here?
Well, I don't know. Probably my next big trip is I've got a couple of local speaking events, but I'm actually going to Egypt and speaking at I'll be the keynote speaker in Cairo, Egypt, at the Al-Azhar Faculty of Medicine. So they met me through Facebook and they said, will you come and be a speaker? And they're flying me to Egypt to come and talk about bone and soft tissue tumors and DermPath, which is awesome because I get to go to Egypt and also to meet all these people that I've interacted with online and to teach there. It's really exciting. I've always wanted to go to Egypt since I was a kid, so I'm really excited from that aspect. But I'm also really excited to be able to visit that part of the world and to be able to share medical knowledge there, because there are sick people all over the world, and the more people I can train, then the more they can help their own patients. And that's why I'm a doctor in the first place.
So just really quickly, because I think it's super relevant, if people are inspired, want to find you on social media now, do they just need to search for your name on the different platforms?
Sure.
How do they find you?
Well, my name's spelled weird. So if you look up J.M. Gardner, M.D., you'll find me.
Great. Thank you so much for being here, Jared. And if you have enjoyed this conversation, which it's been great fun for me, come up to Hibernia Irish Tavern. It's over in West Little Rock. Jared will be joined by two other panelists continuing our conversation on the science of social media. Sandra McGrew, Director of Content Marketing for Godotti Communications, and Sebastian Montez, who works in the cyber division of the Little Rock Field Office of the FBI. We're going to be there from 7 to 9 tonight. It's going to be a lot of good conversation, good food, and good drink. Thank you, Jared, for 89.1 KUAR and Science Cafe. I'm Dorothy Graves.
This is 89.1 KUAR Little Rock, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. KUAR is news and culture for Arkansas. Show your support by becoming a sustaining member at KUAR.org.